Look, said Sideman, when things are on sale, you tend to buy more. Mindtree offered a sale not on last season's closeout, but on top-notch software engineering talent that I would have been hard-pressed to find elsewhere. I needed to spend a lot of money defending and extending my core business and continue to take care of my customers who were working off my current programs. And at the same time, I had to make a giant leap to offer my customers what they were asking for next, which was a much more robust and total online solution to all their ethics, governance, and compliance questions. If I don't meet their needs, someone else will. Partnering with Mindtree allows me to basically have two teams. One team, mostly Americans, that is focused on defending and extending our core business, and the other team, including our Indian consultants, focused on making our next strategic leap to grow our business. Have no doubt, there are firms that do and will outsource good jobs just to save money and disperse it to shareholders or management. To think that is not happening or will not happen is beyond naive. But firms that are using outsourcing primarily as a tool to cut costs, not enhance innovation and speed growth, are the minority, not the majority. And I would not want to own stock in any of them. This is about trying to get bigger, faster, about how we make our next leap in less time with greater assurance of success, said Sideman of his decision to source critical areas of development of his new platform to Mindtree. It is not about cutting corners. We have over 200 clients all over the world now. If I can grow this company the way that I want to, I will be able to hire even more people in all our current offices, promote even more people, and give our current employees even more opportunities and more rewarding career paths, because LRN's agenda is going to be broader, more complex, and more global. We are in a very competitive space. This decision to use outsourcing is all about playing offense, not defense. I am trying to run up the score before it's run up on me. Geopolitics and the Flat World. On a trip back home to Minnesota in the winter of 2004, I was having lunch with my friends Ken and Jill Greer at Perkins Pancake House when Jill mentioned that the state had recently passed a new gun law. The Conceal and Carry Law, passed on May 28, 2003, established that local sheriffs had to issue permits for anyone other than those with felony records or declared mentally ill, who requested to carry concealed firearms to work, unless the person's employer explicitly restricted that right. The reason this all came up at our lunch was that Jill mentioned that at health clubs around the city, where she played tennis, she noted two signs now popping up regularly, one right after the other. At their tennis club in Bloomington, for example, there is a sign right by the front door that says, "No guns allowed." And then nearby, outside the locker rooms, is another sign, "No cell phones allowed." No guns or cell phones allowed? Guns, I understand, I said, but why cell phones? Silly me. It was because some people were bringing cell phones with cameras into locker rooms, covertly taking pictures of naked men and women, and then emailing them around the world. What will they think of next? Whatever the innovation, people will find a way to use it and abuse it. Mark Stein, writing in the National Review, October 25, 2004, related a story from the London Arabic newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi, about a panic that broke out in Khartoum, Sudan, after a crazy rumor swept the city, claiming that if an infidel shook a man's hand, that man could lose his manhood. What struck me about the story, wrote Stein, was a detail. The hysteria was spread by cell phones and text messaging. Think about that. You can own a cell phone, yet still believe a foreigner's handshake can melt away your penis. What happens when that kind of technologically advanced primitivism advances beyond text messaging? This is not a chapter about cell phones, so why do I raise these stories? Because ever since I began writing about globalization, I've been challenged by critics along one particular line. Isn't there a certain technological determinism to your argument? To listen to you, Friedman, there are these 10 flatteners, they are converging and flattening the earth, and there is nothing that people can do but bow to them and join the parade. And after a transition, everyone will get richer and smarter and it will all be fine. But you're wrong, because the history of the world suggests that ideological alternatives and power alternatives have always arisen to any system, and globalization will be no different. This is a legitimate question, so let me try to answer it directly. I am a technological determinist, guilty as charged. I believe that capabilities create intentions. If we create an internet where people can open an online store and have global suppliers, global customers, and global competitors, they will open that online store or bank or bookshop. The history of economic development teaches this over and over. If you can do it, you must do it. Otherwise, your competitors will. But while I am a technological determinist, I am not a historical determinist. There is absolutely no guarantee that everyone will use these new technologies or the triple convergence for the benefit of themselves, their countries, or humanity. We can only hope that more people in more places will use them to create, collaborate, and grow their living standards, not the opposite. But it doesn't have to happen. To put it another way, I don't know how the flattening of the world will come out. Indeed, this is the point in this audio program where I have to make a confession. I know that the world is not flat. Yes, you heard me right. I know that the world is not flat. Don't worry, I know. I am certain, though, that the world has been shrinking and flattening for some time now, and that process has quickened dramatically in recent years. Half the world today is directly or indirectly participating in the flattening process or feeling its effects. But I am equally certain that it is not historically inevitable that the rest of the world will become flat, or that the already flat parts of the world won't get unflattened by war, economic disruption, or politics. There are hundreds of millions of people on this planet who have been left behind by the flattening process, or feel overwhelmed by it, and some of them have enough access to the flattening tools to use them against the system, not on its behalf. How the flattening could go wrong is the subject of this chapter, and I approach it by trying to answer the following questions. What are the biggest constituencies, forces, or problems impeding this flattening process, and how might we collaborate better to overcome them?